We now begin our brief survey of Islam, the last of the five religions that we will be considering in the course. And we start, of course, with the life of Muhammad. Where else would you start? Muhammad was born in, as near as we can figure, in 571, about 570 years after Jesus. And we do know that he died in 632. He was born into an Arab tribe and had a rough childhood. His father died before he was born. His mother died when he was six. He was raised by grandparents. He did not come from money. They were not wealthy, and neither were they starving, but it's not a background from which he was well off or anything like that. During his younger years, he apparently had some contact with Jews and Christians. It's controversial how much. There are traditions that say that he bumped into Jews and Jewish and Christian caravans and talked with them. And then other people say that those traditions aren't reliable. We do know, though, that somewhere along the line, he acquired a great respect for Scripture, for the Hebrew and Old Testament and the Greek New Testament. And the Quran itself refers to Torah and Gospel. As he got older, he married and was leading a perfectly normal life when it was suddenly interrupted by revelation from God. This is his report of it. He was spoken to by the angel Gabriel. And the Quran defends the authenticity of this in these words. By the star when it plunges, your comrade is not astray, neither errs, nor speaks he out of caprice. This is nothing but a revelation revealed, taught him by one terrible in power, very strong. He stood poised, being on the higher horizon, then drew near and suspended hung. Or nearer, then revealed to his servant what he revealed. His heart lies not of what he saw. What, will you dispute with him when he tells you what he saw? But of course, Muhammad himself was terribly shaken up by this sudden approach of divine revelation. He went, after the first one, he went home and said to his wife, Khadija, I'm worried about myself. Then I told her the whole story. She said, rejoice, for by Allah, Allah will never put you to shame. By Allah, you are mindful of your kinsfolk, you speak truthfully, and you render what is given you in trust. You bear burdens, and you are hospitable to guests, and you always do the right against any wrong. Then she took me to Waraka. And she said, listen to him. So he questioned me, and I told him the whole story. This is the law which was set down upon Moses. Another early tradition has Muhammad say about this event. Now it so happened that no creature of Allah was more loathsome to me than a poet, the sight of whom I could neither stand nor bear. So I said, that one, meaning himself, has become either a poet or a man possessed by jinn. This is a kind of spirit. We often say genie, but the Arab word is J-I-N-N, jinn. I will go down to some high mountain cliff and cast myself off that I may kill myself and be at rest. And I went off with this in my mind, but when I was in the midst of the mountains, I heard a voice from heaven saying, O Muhammad, you are indeed Allah's apostle, and I am Gabriel. And at that I raised my head to the skies, and there was Gabriel in clear human form, with his feet on the edges of the skies, and I began to turn my face to the whole expanse of the skies, but no matter in what direction I looked, I saw him. So this is the beginnings of his call as prophet. He's receives this revelation from the angel Gabriel, and he becomes convinced that he's not crazy, but that it's genuine revelation. There was, of course, pagan religion already rampant among the tribes in Arabia, and some of that worship centered around a great rock called the Kaaba. It was a black meteorite that had crashed into the desert a long time before and had been regarded by the tribes as a sacred spot. They used to sacrifice animals there and make prayers there. Nearby was a well called Zumtum that was also considered sacred. And Muhammad appropriates these things. He includes them in the genuine worship of God. He goes to the rock and eliminates all of the idols to pagan gods, and wants only the true creator God to be worshipped there. This is a message that he brings to all the Arabs, and to understand this, you must understand the way in which he looks upon the Jewish and Christian traditions. For Muhammad, the covenant that God made with Abraham, that went then to Isaac and Jacob and so on, was the covenant he made with the Jews. He made that covenant with Abraham. But there's an incident in the Abraham story in which Abraham's wife becomes envious of her maidservant Hagar, and she sends Hagar away in the wilderness to die. And an angel rescues Hagar. In Muslim teaching, this angel mediates a new covenant to people who are not Jews, to Gentiles. Hagar and her son Ishmael are not Jews, because the first Jew is Isaac, the first child of promise, covenant promise to Abraham. But there's a separate covenant with Hagar and Ishmael for non-Jews, and it is that covenant that Muhammad claims to speak for. And so in Muslim doctrine, Jesus is the Messiah for the Jews, and they were wrong to reject him. But for non-Jews, the prophet that mediates that covenant is Muhammad, and all Gentiles are wrong to reject Muhammad. This message is taken by Muhammad to the leaders in Mecca, which is the nearest city where he lives, and they laugh him to scorn, dismiss him. So he leaves Mecca and goes to a nearby city that becomes later renamed Medina, which means the city of the prophet. And he preaches this same message to the men of Medina, and they are converted. They believe this. They believe him to be the messenger, the prophet, speaking for God, receiving messages from Gabriel, and they accept this new religion. And Muhammad then puts together an army from Medina and goes back to Mecca and conquers Mecca and forces the people of Mecca to conform to this one religion, this one true religion. It's the only major world religion to have spread in that way, that is, by the threat of force, by being conquered and then you're told either you convert or you're beheaded. Muhammad only gave that choice, that terrible choice, to pagans, however. Jews and Christians he regarded as what he called people of the book. Jews are accepting the older covenants, Christians have a newer one, and mine is to be added to the Christian one, just as the Christian one was added to the older one. But he respected that they were believers in the true transcendent creator God and not in pagan deities. So Jews and Christians were to be treated in an exceptional way. They were not beheaded for not becoming Muslims. They were, however, considered second-class citizens and forced to pay what's called the infidel tax, the tax for being unbelievers and not followers of Muhammad. And they were forbidden from holding offices in public office. Muhammad is a very persuasive fellow. He's able to bring this message to these people in Medina and then in Mecca and consolidate his hold there and his rule. There's but one God, he says, not one among three. That's a misunderstanding of the Trinity. But Trinity doesn't say there are three gods, three persons in one God. God replicated, but he missed that. Muhammad is his messenger or prophet, but there so are Abraham and Moses and Jesus. They were prophets as well, according to Muhammad. And we've already talked about the parts of the New Testament that say that the canon is closed and that God has finished speaking in Jesus Christ. But Muhammad dismisses those parts of the New Testament as later additions. They must have been sneaked back in there by Christians wanting to have a way to rule out Islam, rule out him, Muhammad. Of course, that's a wildly implausible reply because there are thousands of Greek manuscripts of the New Testament and that include that part of the book of Hebrews that date from way before Muhammad was born. He continues to get the revelations and to consolidate them, have them written down, and that is what the Quran is. It is the record. Of these revelations from the angel Gabriel. Of course, there are also collections of sayings of Muhammad and comments on the Quran, known as the Hadith. And these also are held in great esteem and regarded by most Muslims as inspired by God. These doctrines include not only the doctrines about the God having revealed himself in the past and made covenants with Abraham and so on, but then also there is a great emphasis on the late Jewish prophets and the New Testament teachings of a last judgment, that there will be an end of time when God calls everyone before his throne and judges all people according to their works, whether they be good or evil. And there places a very great emphasis for Muhammad on the Last Judgment. Here's what the Quran says. God has cursed the unbelievers and prepared for them a blaze therein to dwell forever. They shall find neither protector nor helper. Upon the day when their faces are turned about in the fire, they will say, "Ah, oh, if only we had obeyed God and His messenger." The companions of the left, mid burning winds and boiling waters, in the shadow of smoking blaze, neither cool, neither godly, then you erring ones, you that cried out lies, you shall eat of a tree called Zakum. It's a tree that comes forth in the root of hell. Its spathes are the heads of Satan's, and they eat of it and fill their bellies, and on top of it they have a brew of boiling water. The tree of Ek Zakum is the food of the guilty, like molten copper bubbling in the belly as boiling water bubbles. Take him, thrust him into the midst of hell, and then pour over his head the chastisement of boiling water. By contrast, it says, surely the God-fearing shall be in a station secure among gardens and fountains, robed in silk and brocade, set face to face. Upon close-wrought couches reclining upon them, set face to face immortal youths, going round them with goblets and ewers and a cup from a spring. No brows, no intoxication, and such fruits as they shall choose, and such flesh as fowl as they desire. And wide-eyed houris, as these are young ladies, as the likeness for that they labored, a recompense for which they worked, and we made them spotless virgins, chaste, amorous, like of age, for the companions of the right. So here we have the stark contrast between the fate that awaits those who reject the prophet and his message and those who believe it and live a right conduct of life. That right conduct is also important. It's not just belief. And here's what the Quran has to say about that. It's not piety that you turn your faces to the east or the west. True piety is this: believe in God and the last day, the angels, the book, and the prophets. To give one's substance, give money, however cherished, to kinsmen and orphans, the needy, the traveler, beggars. To give ransom to the slave. To perform prayer and pay alms. This means giving to the poor. And they who fulfill their covenant when they have engaged in the covenant and endure with fortitude misfortune, hardship, and peril, these are the ones who are true in their faith and the truly God-fearing. They are good parents, whether one or both of them attains old age. Do not chide them or speak words that are not respectful. And lower to them the wing of humbleness out of mercy and say, "My Lord, have mercy on them, as they raised me up when I was little." It's respect for parents and giving to the poor and so on. All this is practical advice. This is what Allah expects of His followers. Slay not your children for fear of poverty. We will provide for you and them. Surely, killing them would be a grievous sin. And approach not fornication, its indecency, and evil as a way. Give to the orphans their property. And don't exchange the corrupt for the good, and so on. It goes on. It sounds, of course, very like the kind of advice you get in the Proverbs of the Old Testament. There are five pillars of religious duty that are crucial to Islam. And these five central teachings are, first of all, the creed. And the creed is to say there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is His prophet or disciple. And then there's the keeping of the prayers. That's the second thing. The prayers are to be offered five times a day. So Muslims keep a little prayer rug with them that they can put down so they can kneel toward and pray toward Mecca. And then the third thing is to give alms. We heard that already. The giving of money to support the poor and the needy. And the fourth and fifth things have to do with ceremonies. The month of Ramadan is a month of fasting. You don't eat from sunrise to sundown. You can eat after sundown, but you don't eat all during the day to remind you of your sin and to be repentant for your sin and to pray for forgiveness. And then there's the pilgrimage or Hajj. Sometimes it's spelled with a D. And this is the once-in-a-lifetime trip to the Kaaba, to the sacred stone, to worship there, since Muhammad made it a special sacred place himself. And so every Muslim is to travel there at least once in a lifetime and to circle the Kaaba and to offer prayers. Those are the five main things. If you acknowledge God, the transcendent creator, that Muhammad is his disciple, if you then offer the prayers five times a day, the keep almsgiving as a way of life, and then you practice observing Ramadan, and in addition, you make the pilgrimage, you've done the five central things required by Islam. So, we've gotten to the central, the core of this already. It's in fact relatively simple. There is nothing like the elaborate system of rites and rituals and holy days and laws that came out of the Jewish kosher law, for example. It's just relatively straightforward. And it, in that respect, it's more streamlined compared to Judaism. And in some ways, it's closer, more organized, more like Christianity than it is Judaism. The five pillars are relatively simple to observe and easy to do. And that's all one has to do to be a Muslim. So it had great appeal among the Arab tribes, and it spread. Muhammad did spread it by conquest. Having conquered Mecca, he puts together the armies of Medina and Mecca and goes to the next city and conquers that, and then puts that army together and goes and conquers the next. And it spread by power of the sword and by threat. It's the only major religion to have done that. I'm not saying that members of other religions haven't at times given in to something like that, but it was not a policy of the religion and was not the very means by which it initially spread. When we come back next time, we'll talk about some of the controversies and different schools of thought that have risen in Islam and with respect to both doctrine and practice. And we'll be able to cover that in, I think, two more lectures. We'll be able to give you this survey. Again, I admonish you to do the reading, because there's a great deal more in the reading than I'm covering. I'm covering some things not in the reading, but you put the two together to get the entire picture and prepare yourself for the exam.